If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Greatest Games podcast on the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With me is Jonathan Wilson. And with us today is Nick Miller, writer for The Athletic and editor of the Totally Football Yearbook. Nick, pleasure to have you on the pod.
Pleasure to be on. Thank you very much.
Today, we go back to the European Cup semi-final second leg in 1979 that finished FC Köln 0, Nottingham Forest 1. Nick, why have you chosen this game?
Well, as a Nottingham Forest supporter, I need the sort of comfort of nostalgia, and, you know, only seems right when I'm on a podcast with Brian Clough's biographer to choose one of his most glorious games. The two European Cup finals weren't sort of particularly good or interesting games, and, you know, a lot's been said about them. So, but this one, I mean, the second leg, but the tie as a whole was kind of much more tense and exciting. So That's why I picked those two. This one,
a fine choice. And as you say, yeah, Jonathan, little plug, has written a biography about Brian Clough. So you must be delighted with this choice as well, Jonathan.
Absolutely, yes. It's called Nobody Ever Says Thank You. If people haven't yet bought it, and it's very long, I will say for it.
Detailed, Jonathan. Detailed.
Yeah, it is detailed. Well, I actually. I read back the chapter this morning for this, And maybe I shouldn't say this, but my feeling with that book is that it's too long, that I should have had less detail. But what I wanted to do was, and it was so two things. So one, and I found this when I did the detailed books on United and Liverpool as well, the tendency is to think of that period of Forest history as being, you know, huge success, and it's all, everything's golden, and there's this sort of sense of euphoria all the time. But actually, going through the Nottingham Evening Post, and it is Nottingham Evening Post. Have I got that right? That is the local paper, yeah. You realise, actually, there's a huge amount of friction all the time. And that's not just a club. I mean, it's obviously is partly a club thing. But it's also true of Busby. It's also true of Shankly. That there's loads of doubts. There's loads of little minor incidents. I wanted to sort of get across, this is actually exhausting for everybody. It's not just this golden period. It is tough. And the other thing, and I think Clough himself talks about this, sort of a decade on, that he clearly gets worn down by just how many games there are, that he feels you can't celebrate because you've got another game 3 or 4 days later. And so he's constantly trying to justify his drinking. But, if I don't drink now, when will I drink? Yeah, we've just beaten Luton 1-0, so I've got to get pissed because on Wednesday we're playing Oldham or whatever it happens to be. And I wanted to sort of get across that relentless nature that football has. I think even the greats, it kind of breaks. And I think that's one of the things that broke Clough. So unfortunately, I feel readers at the end of the book will feel exhausted and broken by it. But that's deliberate. Yeah. That's the art of it.
Yeah, you've tried to, capture that spirit of sort of exhaustion and so on.
Yeah, and I think it's also why David Peace does it in the Shankly book in Red or Dead. The that very repetitive style of and on whatever the date is, Liverpool Football Club played Everton Football Club and won 2-0, and the two goals were scored by Ian St. John. And then on whatever date they played Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, and because that is what football's like. And when you've been in it, I mean, I've been a journalist now for, 22 years. And obviously COVID's actually given us all a break, but that relentless churn of, in a week going, Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, Newcastle, London, just constantly sort of spinning around. And I you're writing that book, I got a sense of one of the things that wore Clough down and just why he was so sort of fractious and broken by the end.
The other thing about the book is that there's so perhaps more than any other kind of figure in sort of modern-ish English football, there's so many sort of myths and half-truths and stories about Clough that people repeat because they kind of want to believe them. And I think we sort of needed a book like this to kind of to just look at some of, you know, look at actually what happened and whether some of those stories were true. And there are a few in there that that Clough talked about a lot, which you sort of looked at and said, well, actually, that didn't happen.
Yeah, and I feel we're talking about the book now rather than the game. But that's fine. I'm all in favour of that. But I think a lot of those examples are quite telling. So there's his mother's death is clearly a huge, huge moment. I mean, it's obviously a huge moment in anybody's life, but he was very, very close to his mother. And he always said it happened on the night that they lost to Juventus. Derby lost to Juventus in the European Cup semi-final. And it didn't. It happened the night they beat Spartak Trnava in the quarterfinal. And now I don't. He's not lying. He's not making that up. He's just conflated the two events. But I think they're significant because, one of my arguments in the book is he felt really guilty and really ashamed of having failed as 11 plus. He was a huge family. I think 9 brothers and 2 sisters or something. And I think it was only him and one other failed at 11 plus, and he felt he'd let his mother down. And his way of making that up was to win medals. And so this must be early 90s when he's talking about, I guess, his grandkids getting their A-levels. And he's going, yes, but I've got 2 European Cups and they're my A-levels. But not really. They're actually a lot more significant than A-levels. But he's somehow equating them. And so I think the reason the European Cup becomes a quest for him, mm-hmm. and here, I do drag it back to the game. The reason it is so significant to him is that I think when, as he sees it, he's cheated by Juventus. And from his point of view, that has prevented him delivering to his mother before she dies the ultimate prize. That's why he's so desperate to win. And I think that even explains why he goes to Leeds. Because Derby obviously weren't in the European Cup in 74-5, but Leeds were. And so he can immediately have another crack at the European Cup and he can try and win this prize for his mother, who's just died. And any logic would have said, don't take that job. It's not the right job for you. Yeah, this is quite apart from anything else and all the friction between him and Revy and certain players. It's an old side. It needs ripping apart and starting again. Revy couldn't face doing it. So why are you going to do it when they all hate you anyway? And maybe it was just his ego. He thought, well, I can do anything. But I think that may be the underlying impetus that he sort of thinks, right, I want to win it now and get straight in there and win this for my mother. Mm-hmm. But I mean, actually, again, this links us into this season because he takes an astonishing risk at the beginning of the season that the sale of Peter Wyth is a ludicrous thing to do. It makes no sense at all. So they win the title with Peter Wyth being an integral part of the side. And the start of the season, he sells them for $250,000 to Newcastle, which leaves him with 2 forwards, Steve Elliott, who with the best one in the world nobody's heard of today, and Gary Birtles, who is a kid who hasn't played.
Yeah, he's probably
19, had he played one game 20, for them?
20 years old.
They signed him from semi-professional football and he was a carpet fitter, I think, before.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
That
was 1976 they signed Birtles, I think.
Yeah, but he's young. Right? So I think he's played one game and
his
second game against Arsenal. His third game is a 2-0 win over Liverpool in the European Cup.
Yeah.
When he scores one and sets one up.
Yeah, but Clough knows a player when he sees one, though.
Well, in those days he did, but it just sort of felt like he could do. And I think this is the amazing thing about him at this point, that almost everything he does comes off.
Yeah, I mean, Nick, it is quite remarkable. You're obviously a Forest fan, and this is the most successful period in the club's history. It was the first time they won the top flight. And a first and only time they've won the top flight was, of course, against Clough in the previous season to this one. They go on, back-to-back European Cups. But this season itself didn't start brilliantly. It was 6 draws from their opening 7 matches. They did go on to break the record for consecutive league matches unbeaten, previously held by Donrevy's Leeds, which would have pleased Clough no end, I'm sure. But in those days, it was a very different footballing landscape, of course, because Forest came up and won the old first division at the first time of asking. So when they start the season not in brilliant fashion, one might have not thought they would go on to win the European Cup.
Well, I mean, no, and particularly then, you know, Liverpool were obviously the sort of dominant force, and they were kind of sort of, I think, slightly punch drunk at this sort of, as they saw it, upstart club. Well, I mean, that were really a kind of upstart club who'd come up and taken their title. And they, you know, they won the league quite handily that year. But when Forest were drawn against them in the first round of the European Cup, there was a sort of, I mean, there was a sense of disappointment at Forest, I think, partly because, you know, the thing we always say when two English teams, it doesn't feel like a European game. They were, you know, looking forward to going to, you know, Munich or Milan or whatever it was. And as it was, they were playing the team that they, you know, played twice a year anyway. But also Liverpool were just kind of, it's like they took it personally. The Forest had beaten them, and sort of to this day, well, less perhaps in a sort of minor way, Liverpool still have occasionally sing songs about, you know, Forest being rivals, despite the fact that Forest haven't been in any way relevant for, you know, to Liverpool anyway, for the better part of, you know, 25 years. There's a story that John O'Hare, was a sort of reserve, you know, attacker slash sort of utility player in this team. Years and years later, he was doing some scouting for, I think, Leicester or someone, and he showed up at Anfield, and he said, you know, my name's John O'Hare, and the parking attendant told him to fuck off. We don't like you here.
And I mean, he'd also been in the Derby team that nicked the title off Liverpool under Clough.
Yeah, but he. But
it, what a feather in your cap, though.
Yeah, but it's just kind of remarkable how long that sort of antipathy towards Forest continued. You know, that Forest finished third or fourth a few times following this kind of real glory period, but they weren't really sort of serious challengers to Liverpool's dominance in the 80s. But these couple of seasons had such a sort of huge impact on them.
Yeah, I mean, Bertels himself, years later in an interview, said that looking at a couple of the kind of big banners and flags waved in the Kop End at Anfield, he said he always looks at it and sees the European Cup wins 77, 78, 81, and he goes, ah, a couple of gaps there, that's good of us, you know, which is quite enjoyable. But Jonathan, this Nottingham Forest side, at the time, I believe I'm right in saying that, they were often described as like this ragtag bunch of players or mercenaries, almost, or perhaps that's not.
Why
don't they
mercenaries? I think ragtag is sort of the right term, because I mean, they've been plucked from all over the place. The Bertels, you know, a carpet fitter with literally no pedigree.
Long Eaton United. I mean, have you heard of them?
I mean, only through Gary Bertels.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Who in the end of his first season ended up winning the European Cup. But even somebody like John Robertson has been widely written off by other people. And, he doesn't look like a footballer. He doesn't act like a footballer. He doesn't train like a footballer. He doesn't eat or drink like a footballer. But at that point, Clough and Taylor had this pretty much infallible knack of working out exactly what they needed and putting all the parts together. And yes, this is one of the things that sort of, doing the book, I found quite difficult about Clough, because he's so scathing about tactical discussions and so scathing about coaching courses and things. And it, you know, tactics don't matter. Well, they clearly do, because you spend ages kind of going out and getting the right player, and you know exactly how to fit them together. So what is that if that's not tactics? And there's a story. So the first round, they draw Liverpool, of course, are European champions, which is why there's the two English teams in the competition. That season, they win 2-0 at home, Liverpool sort of admit they got suckered into trying to find an equaliser when they didn't really need to. They were sort of, it's Forest, therefore we need to get at least a draw, as if it was a league game. Whereas, you know, against a foreign opponent, they might have thought, well, 1-0 away, that's fine. We'll win it back at Anfield. So Forest go to Anfield. And Clough's all this thing about our tactics, nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And then as they're going out the dressing room, he takes Archie Gemmell aside and says, imagine you're a right back today. And that's all he says to him. Because he wants to double up on the right-hand side against Callaghan, would it have been, on the left Liverpool then? Whoever it was on the left Liverpool. Well, again, what's that but tactics? And, yeah, you know, they hold Liverpool at arm's length, and which they're very good at. I mean, I think that's something that happens midway through that first season up. The first half of the season, they're quite open, they're quite fluent. There's a game when around about Christmas when they beat United 4-0 or 4-1 at Old Trafford.
4-0, it was 4-0, and it could have been about 8 that game.
Yeah. And then there's an interview with Peter Taylor after that where you know, he says to whoever's interviewing, well, don't think you're going to see that again. And they shut up shop and play for 0-0s and 1-0s. And they're very good at it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is really sort of stands them in good stead for the European campaign. Although this Köln game nearly goes pretty badly wrong early.
Because they score a few goals in the European Cup on their way to the final. I mean, was it AEK Athens? Was it 7-2 on aggregate? And then Grasshoppers in the quarterfinal, 5-2 on aggregate.
But I mean, the AEK game, they win 2-1 away, and then they just sort of pick them off on the break at home, don't they? It's one of those kind of 5-1 wins where, well, yeah, it is 5-1, but it's not like it was sort of 70% possession camped in their half 5-1. Mm-hmm. But that game, the game in Athens, you sort of Clough's ability to, or willingness to pick fights. You have a famous, I mean, he and Larry Lloyd basically didn't speak to each other for 2 or 3 months after that game, because the morning after the game, they're in the hotel, they're going to the airport, and they get down to the bus. And Clough realises everybody's wearing their club blazers apart from him and Larry Lloyd. So he goes off and gets changed, comes down and bollocks Lloyd for not being smart enough and tells him to go off and get changed. And Lloyd refuses because he knows his blazer's in the bottom of his case and can't be bothered. But I mean, then the story gets more ludicrous, that he wants to fight you. He gives him an envelope with the details of his fine, which I think was £100. And Lloyd starts to complain. And Clough says, well, I'll fine you £50 more for every word you say. So Lloyd goes, make it 500. And they sort of storm off. Lloyd then comes to apologise to him the next week. And Clough's gone on holiday to Spain and not told anybody. So while he's away, Lloyd pays the fine. But there's a long period of friction between Clough and, you know, his dominant centre-back.
Yeah. Lloyd was really interesting because he was that sort of classic tough guy character, actually, apparently really sort of craved praise from, you know, a father figure. So Clough used to do this thing, like the okay gesture, where he put his thumb and his middle finger together, and if someone did something good on the pitch, he'd do that, and that would be his, that would be the kind of the ultimate approval. This was the, you know, the king bestowing his his approval on you. And he never did that to Larry Lloyd because he knew that Lloyd just sort of craved it so much that he would try again. And the more he saw, I don't know whether he gave it, gave that symbol excessively to Kenny Burns, his centre-back partner, but he would do it very, very deliberately to other players, but never to Larry Lloyd.
Poor old Larry. All right, chaps, let's have a quick break and then we'll talk about the match itself. See you in a moment, everybody.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to The Greatest Games on the Blizzard. One man we haven't spoken about. You mentioned him earlier. Jonathan was John Robertson, a crucial player. And it was funny when you say about it being a long season. Just having a look at the kind of amount of appearances and so on. Just to back that up, he played 63 games that season. in an era of very heavy pitches, strong tackles, not much nutrition with regards to diets and so on.
Well, particularly not for him.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. And Peter Shilton also had 63 appearances.
Well, I mean, they won the League Cup, didn't they? So, and that's one of the reasons for that. So they win the League Cup and the European Cup. So that's two long runs. Mm-hmm. I think two or three FA Cup games. So...
Yeah,
that. But yeah, you're right.
It's a phenomenal shift that he's put in, and I mean, Clough said about John Robertson. I just have to squeeze this quote in. John Robertson was a very unattractive man. If one day I felt a bit off colour, I would sit next to him. I was bloody Errol Flynn in comparison. But give him a ball and a yard of grass, and he was an artist, the Picasso of our game. Now, Nick, for a player who really wasn't doing much until Clough came along, it's a rare piece of high praise from Clough himself. But how important was Robertson to this side?
Well, he was everyone who is in that team will describe him as a genius. And, this was all before my time, so I have to rely on these kind of testimonies. But, I mean, he was a genius over about 5 yards. He was... a left wing. I think possibly one of the reasons that he was able to sustain that amount of games in the season. I think he was exactly a workhorse. He would he would conserve his energy, I think, just for the real sort of crucial parts. But he would get the ball, and he was one of those kind of old wingers who'd do the same thing every time. Basically, he would just sort of lure the defender in and then shift it to his left or right foot, and produce these incredible crosses and incredible moments of inspiration. And I think certainly a couple of that team that I've spoken to have said that while Clough was the genius that sort of knitted everything together, they wouldn't have won anything without John Robertson in the team. He scored the goal, scored the winning goal in the 1980 European Cup final. He set up the goal in the 79 final. He scored some massive goals, including the first leg of this tie. Then he sort of set up the winning goal in the second leg as well, which we'll go on to talk about later. But yeah, he was a phenomenal creative player that sort of symbolised everything that Clough did. He was sort of on the verge, certainly being sold, possibly even of, I think, giving up football entirely when Clough arrived. He was just this sort of overweight, no-hoper of a central midfielder, I think. Mm. And then Clough and Taylor turned him into this genius left winger.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they needed to set up a team around him, right? So the left back would always be a very defensive left back, so be that Frank Clark or Frank Gray. Or, I mean, Frank Gray did get forward a bit more, I guess. Or Ian Bowyer played quite a lot at left back.
Colin Barrett as well.
Yeah. And then on the other side, you'd have either O'Neill or Archie Gemmell tucking in as quite a narrow right-sided player. And width was offered on the right from Viv Anderson overlapping. So again, there's this idea that Clough didn't do tactics. It's nonsense. The team's incredibly well-balanced.
Yeah.
And that sort of feeds into the mythology thing as well, because the players are, of that era, are very keen to emphasise the sort of mythology of Clough didn't do tactics. Like there's an interview with Kenny Burns, I think, where he said one day he asked about free kicks, and what do we do at free kicks? And Clough said, well, shoot. And they said, well, what about indirect free kicks? And he goes, pass it sideways and then shoot. And which is, you know... He clearly didn't do, build these kind of 100-page dossiers like Don Revy did at Leeds. But as Jonathan says, there was a clearly more thought and more sort of nuance went into it than he or kind of most of the team wanted to let on.
And there's also, he meets Taylor when they're both players at Middlesbrough. And they're sort of there, they're seen as being a little bit odd because they just want to talk about football all the time. And there's these stories of taking long walks round and round Albert Park, which is where Clough's statue now is, for hours upon hours. And, after Clough marries, Taylor would come round and would spend hours with him or Clough would go to Taylor's house. What are they talking about if they're not talking about, to an extent, tactics and how players fit together? They can't just be going, well, he's good, he's not good, he's good, he's not good. The conversation has to be about more than that. So if they're talking about how you build a team, which we're told is the basis of them working together first at Hartlepool's and then later, they must be talking about tactics. It's the only thing they can be talking about, even if they didn't call it that, even if they didn't have grand philosophical terms, even if they weren't, you know, drawing incredibly detailed diagrams. That has to be fundamentally what they're talking about.
Romance, Jonathan, the roar of the crowds, the sound of the leather of the ball, all these things that they could have been talking about.
Exactly. What it would be like to live in Brighton, that kind of thing. But it's safe to say that if Clough makes a bold statement or says something, then probably the opposite is true. the whole thing about Trevor Francis, you know, signed him for a quid less than £1 million, yet you dig into it and it was slightly over £1 million. But anyway, I mean, that obviously happened.
It's a weird thing I don't understand in football history.
Yeah.
Supposedly when Manchester United signed Tommy Taylor from Barnsley, I think, they paid £29,999 because they didn't want him to be the first £30,000 player. It's just, I just don't understand why not? What's the problem? I think the great story with Francis is the Midlands football writers, had, when Francis was still at Birmingham, had named him their player of the season and Clough gave him the award. And Francis walks onto the stage at this event with his hands in his pockets and Clough bollocks him. And Francis responds to go, "Sorry, sir," and take his hands out of his pockets. And then, you know, 2 months later, he's signing him for £1 million.
Yeah, around about £1 million. But yeah, of course, didn't play in this semi-final tie, which we should talk about. But the first leg, Nick, very entertaining game at the City Ground, ends 3-3. Forest, you know, 2-0 down, they came back, they were 3-2 up, and then 3-3. So it was, I suppose, nicely poised, really, you would say. But with three away goals from Köln, you know, who were favourites because as I understand it, by this point in the European Cup, some of the big sides have gone out. The likes, well, obviously Liverpool at the hands of Forest, but Juventus, Real Madrid had gone out. So was it a case of the winner of this tie would be the favourite to go on and win the final?
Yeah, I mean, very much so. Malmo were sort of, not particularly entertaining or good team. Köln were the favourites, though, as they'd won the German double the previous year. But this is one of the kind of examples of Clough and Taylor's sort of tactics, and I mean that in terms of preparation rather than tactics on the field, went wrong because Taylor basically, so he'd gone to watch Köln play the week before the first leg, and he basically said, "These are shite lads. We're gonna beat them easily." There's a story about him sat with the team, watching the Köln players arrive at the City Ground and basically pointing at every player and saying, "Well, he's no good." But it's like Tony Schumacher and Bernd Schuster, a very young Bernd Schuster, and Dieter Müller, who'd been, I think, Bundesliga top scorer the previous couple of seasons. And he was basically saying, "Well, he can't catch a cold and he's shot, he's no good, nothing to worry about with that guy." He told all the players in their pre-match meal, "Oh, I'll have double, I'll have pudding, you'll be fine. They, you know, these lot are useless." Cut to 20 minutes into the game and Köln were 2-0 up and all the Forest players' heads were spinning.
Yeah. But it was, an entertaining game nonetheless, Jonathan.
Yeah, and they did come back. I mean, you know, it's... Clough and Taylor have been famous for relaxing their players before big games. So, the League Cup final this year where they beat Southampton, you know, famously the night before the game, they get to the hotel and there's huge, you know, there's a crate of champagne and there's jugs of orange juice. And when John O'Hare says, "Oh, I don't like champagne," Clough orders 12 pints of bitter. And, you know, get them pissed and then they're not thinking about the game. Even the Liverpool away game, supposedly they went out for lunch before the game and got through several bottles of Chablis between them. So with all these sort of tactics, they're all sort of nonsensical. None of them are right or wrong, and they're judged entirely by whether they work or not. And the great example of that is Derby beat Spurs, so when Clough's manager of Derby, in a League Cup game, I guess it must be 72 or 73, and it goes to extra time. It's at White Hart Lane. And after 90 minutes, Clough doesn't move from the bench. and Derby going to win it in extra time. Every single paper the next day is the genius of Clough. He knew they had the game in hand. He didn't need to give them any more instructions. So he didn't get involved, kept them calm. And then the 1991 FA Cup final, Forest against Spurs, 1-1 after 90 minutes. Clough doesn't leave the bench. Terry Venables is there giving instructions, cheering everybody up. Spurs go on to win it. And Clough shot because he hasn't been, yeah, he somehow hasn't had the will, the mental fortitude to go and give more instructions. Mm-hmm. So yeah, these things are always, yeah, nonsense. But yeah, probably on this occasion it did over-relax the players, and they, or maybe Kiln would have scored twice anyway. Who knows?
Mm. Well, the second leg, the match in question, of course, Nick, was a very different affair.
They did keep up the same sort of rhetoric. I mean, Taylor sort of said, you know, we lost, you know, we didn't win that because of individual mistakes. There's a couple of individuals who are entirely to blame for this. And I'm pretty sure he's looking at Larry Lloyd when he's saying that.
Well, Shilton for the third goal?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's no reason why he would have done, but the I shouldn't laugh, it's terrible. But the pretty much every paper the next day goes with the Forest sunk by Japanese sub line, which is just so sort of characteristic of the times. But anyway,
For those who don't know, the Japanese sub
came off the bench and scored the equaliser to make it 3-3. Mm-hmm. And Taylor had a £1,000 bet on Forrest to win the second leg. So, and he, I think he said that they Kiln wouldn't be a top half side in the first division.
Yeah, he upgraded before the game. He said they were a Midland League side, and then, you know, he upgraded them to sort of bottom half of the first division after the 3-3 draw. There's also straight after the first leg, Clough gave an absolutely sensational interview to, I read somewhere it's Gary Newbon, which I didn't realize, but he's sort of, it's very odd because he's sort of sat down somewhere and his body, the interviewer is to his left and his body's kind of angled to the right hand side and then the camera's in the middle. So the interviewer asks him questions and he sort of gives his answers sort of half distractedly. And a lot of them where he's looking straight down the barrel of the camera, and the kind of the final line of it was he just had this little smirk on his face and looked directly down the barrel of the camera and said, I do hope anybody's not stupid enough to write us off, and then kept like direct eye contact with the viewers at home just to sort of reinforce the point. And again, it's, you know, this could all be sort of you know, post hoc justification afterwards, but the players have said subsequently that and what Clough and Taylor said after the game is what sort of inspired them and motivated them for the second leg.
Mm. And those interviews, they're just like nothing you get today. I mean, and when Austin Mitchell died, which when we're recording this was it last week or earlier this week?
It was last week, I think, yeah.
Recently. And obviously yeah, there's the famous Austin Mitchell with Clough and Revy after Clough's been sacked by Leeds. But I hadn't seen till he died the clip of the show on calendar when Clough gets the Leeds job, and there's Austin Mitchell and three journalists, and it's sort of half an hour of mesmeric television where these three journalists are all incredibly well briefed. They're asking really tough questions, and Clough is sort of, yeah, sort of 80% batting them away, but the journalists are landing some punches. It's just the level of discourse.
Yeah.
The eloquence of all five people, including Austin Mitchell, the wit of all five of them, it's just incredibly good TV. And I don't understand when, like these days, when we know so much more about television, we know how these things work, how can we not create something that looks like that and sounds like that?
Mm, but maybe we should, Jonathan.
We should.
A meeting for after the podcast, perhaps. But yes, going back to this match, I mean, you talk about, you know, Clough not interested in tactics and all sort of bit of bluster. But it is interesting because it does end 1-0, but it is the same intensity. You know, it's a bit of back and forth. Are you surprised, really, that it does end 1-0? Because one can think on paper that Forest, okay, they go to Germany, they're going to play a bit cagey, hit them on the break and kind of try and snuff out the attack. And of course, in the latter stages of the game, that's what happened.
Not necessarily surprised, because this is, it's kind of what the thing that people generally sort of remember about or say about Brian Clough's teams, particularly Forest, is, you know, very nice team, passing football, attractive football, play football the right way, all that kind of thing. But one of the things that defined the sort of biggest games or the sort of most significant games of that, particularly of that era, were just sort of really sort of dogged, slightly grim defensive displays a lot of the time. So, the second leg against Liverpool in the first round, the game where they won the league against Coventry the previous season, particularly the 1980 final, were sort of fairly kind of grim and, dogged defensive performances by Forest. And, you know, like you said, sort of, I mean, the goal was from a corner, but it came from a counter attack. I don't think it was particularly surprising, because that's kind of what one of the things that this Forest team did and did very well.
So I think that's a really interesting point you raise, because I don't know what you think as a Forest fan, but my sort of sense of this is that when Taylor leaves, when that bus stop happens, the nature of Forest changes. And so before he goes, they're willing to sign players like Larry Lloyd and Kenny Burns and even Robertson. So a difficult character, or characters who have in some way failed before, and they need to be rehabilitated. And then later in the mid-80s, Clough's picking his nice young men with the side partings who would make ideal son-in-laws. And it's almost like he's gone for niceness as a substitute for silverware. And they do win silverware, obviously, you know, the League Cups, but they're not really challenging for the big things. And part of that's financial. But I also think he stopped doing what had made Forrest great. And I wonder whether he needed Taylor to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that they always said was that Taylor spotted the players, or spotted the talent, and then Clough moulded them into what he wanted. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, even the key players in that sort of late 80s team, like, you know, Des Walker and Stuart Pearce, for all Stuart Pearce was sort of a hard man on the pitch, he wasn't a enormously difficult character off it. Most of the players that were key in that era were signed by Clough very young, and then he, rather than, you know, people like Larry Lloyd or Kenny Burns, who had been around the block and just
even needed... Archie Gemmell, you know, had a reputation as being, he was teetotal, but he had a reputation as being difficult.
Archie Gemmell, as the ultimate example of that, when he wasn't picked for the final, sort of stormed off and never played for the club again. He did then come back to be on club's coaching staff. But yeah, that late 80s team, it wasn't quite, you know, Graham Souness's team of son-in-laws that he said about Arsenal, but it wasn't sort of far off. There was, you know, Pearce and Des Walker and obviously Nigel.
People like Steve Hodge and...
Yeah, none of whom you would say were, you know, needed to have their kind of wild personalities reined in.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that sort of leads to Forest's decline, and this is something that sort of crops up this season, so I think it's the day of the home leg of the Grasshoppers game in the quarterfinal, the announcement's made that they're going to spend £2.5 million on a new 8,000-seater stand. And that allied to some bad signings, Peter Ward, Ian Wallace, sort of scuppers Forest financially for 3 or 4 years. And I think that, combined with Taylor going, just sort of drags the level down. They can't ever really quite get back.
And it was part of the reason they broke up the team so, you know, prematurely, quickly. They I think they probably thought that they could sell off the big players and then just do exactly what they'd done before, find someone from somewhere and, repeat the process again. And then when that didn't work, they had to start spending £1 million on Ian Wallace and Justin Fashanu.
Fashanu, obviously, the other one of those three who failed. Yeah, I mean, Fashanu obviously is a bit more complicated, but yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this issue of the ground. So Clough, for the, I think it's the Grasshoppers game, he doesn't allow live radio broadcasts from the ground because he wants fans in because he thinks that's the best way to raise revenues. The when Forest win the quarterfinal of the League Cup, rather than the back page of the Post next day being, you know, celebratory of we're in the League Cup semi-final, it's if crowds don't improve, we're not going to build a new stand for you. So this rumbling in the background, this issue that the crowds aren't quite big enough, the Clough's looking beyond, wanting more, is sort of rumbling there in the background all through this season. Mm. The point Nick made about the doggedness, yeah, which is how I led onto this sort of digression. And I think it is actually similar to the final the following year against Hamburg. And maybe that's something to do with it being against a German team. Maybe you can play against them a certain way. But the thing that strikes me about that final, it was a really interesting dynamic between Brian Moore and Jack Charlton, who were doing the commentary together. And Brian Moore is panicking constantly because Hamburg have a lot of the ball. They spend a lot of the time in the Forest half. And Jack Charlton, who I think in the late 70s, early 80s, is the greatest co-commentator in the history of football, he's just sort of going, nah, they're fine. Forest aren't going to concede. Unless a 30-yard shot goes in the top corner, they're fine. And the longer it goes on, the more you realize, yeah, he's absolutely right. I mean, obviously, I knew the result before I watched that game. But Forest are just holding them sort of 35, 40 yards from goal. And to beat Shilton from that range, it has to be something exceptional. And Shilton, I think, is really, really good at organizing a defense. And his second autobiography is one of the worst autobiographies in history. It's worth reading because I can't think of any other autobiography where I've gone in with a neutral view of a man and come out thinking quite badly of him. His first one is really, which I think comes out in like 1980 or 81. Must be 81 because it's after the two European Cups. And it's really, really good on goalkeeping. And there's stuff in there where he says, it's some of my best games where I haven't touched the ball because I've organised the defence so well. And I think you really see that in this game, in the Hamburg game, that Forest are incredibly well organised and the opposition have loads of the ball, but they're not actually hurting them. And the problem is that I think today we're a bit savvier. We sort of understand that idea that you can control a game without the ball. But back then, that was quite a... Yeah, that just wasn't how people thought. And so commentators were very anxious whenever the opposition had the ball. And actually, if you look at it, yeah, there's what, two half chances for Köln before Forest take the lead? There's the there's a chance where Müller turns Larry Lloyd.
Yeah, it's a pretty decent chance.
Actually, Shilton makes a very good save, low goal kick's given. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, he it's sort of a break, and he spins Lloyd, runs beyond him, and Lloyd gets a bit too tight to him. And then the shot is, it might just be drifting wide anyway, but Shilton makes a very good low save to his right. And then there's the Konopka cross on the right, which everybody sort of leaves, and suddenly you think, oh, Christ, it might be drifting in, and it does just drift wide of the far post. But they're not sort of, it's not sort of sustained pressure.
It should be the Dieter Müller chance that you mentioned there. I think saying that Lloyd got a little bit too close to him is generous. I think he tried to take him out, missed.
Yeah.
And then rectified that quite soon afterwards. hit Müller with a bit of a reducer, and I think Müller had to go off, which, you know, helped for us chances rather.
That's right, yeah, he went off 5 minutes before half time for Hans Fleur, yeah.
And obviously you spoke about it earlier, Nick, but the one goal was enough, and it was Boyer who sort of headed in unmarked from a flick on from a corner. But of course there was still a lot of work to do, because a 1-1 draw would have been okay for Köln, but it was that defensive performance that kind of kept them out. And then on to the final, and it would be that man Trevor Francis who came into the side and got the winning goal.
Yeah, I mean, and the defensive performance that would have been, I think the goal was just after an hour, so there's half an hour of it wasn't quite a siege, but the Köln were definitely kind of, you know, the had more attacks. And my dad always he was at this game, and he always likes to tell the story of having to physically restrain one of the mates who went with him from leaving because his mate couldn't cope with the tension. He his head was exploding, and they had to sort of grab him and keep him in place. But yeah, I think
there's only really that one chance, isn't there? There's a long range Konopka shot which Shilton makes a very good save, and then reacts really quickly to grab the rebound. But apart from that, I'm not sure there's any.
There's a proper goalmouth scramble, which could go
there is
anywhere.
A proper scramble.
Yeah, So
some of the players did say afterwards, "Oh, we weren't that bothered, really. We weren't that fussed." But you know, if you were there and you were kind of, you know, living through it, I think that's it'd be quite a generous description of it.
Yeah, indeed. The only thing, other thing I was going to add is that it may have been more common back then, but where were the dugouts? It just looked like they were sitting on plastic chairs, the men.
Yeah. It's just a sensational pictures of of Clough and only Clough and Taylor. Even I don't know where the subs were or where Jimmy Gordon, the trainer, or anyone like that were. Just those two seemingly sat on this kind of part athletics track around the municipal stadium.
Well, the great thing is they're sitting on those sort of plastic chairs you used to have in assembly at school.
Exactly.
It's just the whole thing looks so sort of tin pot. It's just magnificent.
There was just one thing I was going to say about the goal as well. If it's a corner from the left. John Robertson's takes it with his right foot. There's a Coan player, I'm not sure who it was, who is doing the kind of standing 10 yards away from kind of the sort of mini wall. And just before Robertson runs up to take it, he sort of looks at the Coan player and points sort of over his shoulder as he's kind of doing the your shoelaces are untied thing. The Coan player looks around over his right shoulder, and Robertson then takes the corner as the defender is looking the other way, and then it's flicked on near post by Gary Birtles, and then Ian Bowyer sort of it looks like he sort of slightly misheads it. He's kind of unmarked about 5 yards out, and you know it's while Trevor Francis, the £1 million player, scores the winner in the final. One of the other reasons I picked this game is that the winner was scored by Bowyer, who was one of the five players who was there when Clough arrived when Forest were in the second division, who went on to win the European Cup, and he was just this player who was. He quite literally played in every position. There was a game a couple of years before where Bowyer had to play in goal for a half after the goalkeeper got injured. In the first leg, he played at left back, or he started the game at left back, and in this game, he was in midfield where he would usually play.
That first leg, isn't he? Because Gemmell gets injured, so Frank Clark comes on, so Frank Clark goes to left back, and he moves in midfield. And that is actually what starts the comeback.
There's a Forest writer, and I should probably say a very good friend of mine, called David Marples, who wrote a book about Forest called The History Boys, and he describes Bowyer in that as the heartbeat and the moral anchor of the team, which I thought was a lovely description.
Yeah. Right, another book. We started on a book, we finished on a book.
Yeah, but buy mine, not that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Buy both of them, treat yourself.
Okay, yeah.
They are. You can do that. And of course, Jonathan's book is long. But of course, I believe, Jonathan, that your publisher said to you after your book, which you said was quite a long read. Your publisher said, Jonathan, you're the best long storyteller in the country. And you said, thank you. I'm the best short one, too.
Very good.
Channeling the great man.
Yeah. Feel free to edit that out, Ryan. Nick, it's been fantastic talking to you about Brian Clough. It really has. It's always enjoyable talking about the great man. Thank you very much for coming on the pod.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And I say Brian Clough, it was about Nottingham Forest as well. You see, that's what happens with Clough. It all ultimately talking about him. But there we are. For more stories like that, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. Myself and Jonathan will be back next week with another great game from football. See you then.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.